This is Walk-In's Welcome with Bridget Fettesy. I'm Bridget Fettesy, and you are welcome. You know the drill. Please subscribe, rate, comment, share, reach out, tell your friends, send smoke signals, whatever. We love your feedback and we want to hear from you. If you like our work and want to support us, the best way to do that is join Fettesy.com. You'll get access to behind-the-scenes content, outtakes, discounts on merch, and the ability to submit questions for some of our upcoming guests. Support your favorite scrappy little internet heroes at Fettesy.com.
Hey, this is Adam Carolla. Let me tell you about my podcast. We do it every single day, so you can subscribe, and there'll always be a fresh one waiting for you. It's about 2 hours of topical topics, and news, and guests, and comedians, and, of course, my own vitriolic take on just about everything that's going on in the world. Plus, we get a lot of really interesting, notable people who come in. We'll get politicians, we'll get tastemakers, we'll get stand-ups, we'll get authors, we'll get pundits, we'll get, I think about covers it all, celebrities as well. And we'll do some really interesting interviews with them. You can get The Adam Carolla Show wherever you download your podcast.
This week on the podcast, I am excited to welcome a friend and someone whose mind I respect immensely, Inez Stepman. Inez is a senior policy analyst at Independent Women's Forum and host of High Noon with Inez Stepman, a podcast that hosts conversations with heterodox thinkers on a variety of important cultural and political subjects. She has over a decade of experience in education policy and also handles issues related to institutional capture and the definition of sex in law and culture. I originally booked Inez to talk about the culture wars and how I wanted out of them. And the day that we spoke, the Roe v. Wade overturning occurred. And so obviously that came up in the conversation as well. And it was really thought-provoking and interesting. And she's just so intellectually rigorous. I hope you enjoy. I'm with Inez Stepman, everyone. Welcome to Walk-In's Welcome. Overdue. Way overdue.
So I'm so glad to be here. And any chat with you, Bridget, is overdue. I'm always happy, whether that's, you know, over dinner or now being recorded. I guess that's the only way people have conversations these days. We just podcast every like lunch, every.
Yeah, it's like how I catch up with all my friends now. Like, let's podcast. Well, it's funny. I was having you on the podcast originally. I've wanted to have you on forever for many reasons, a myriad. But lately, after I had a baby, I've been wanting to like pivot out of the culture wars completely. And I kept thinking about, I think it was a tweet you had, but it's something you said, which is you can't really avoid the culture wars. The culture wars will come to you. Maybe you can articulate that a little bit better. And before we get into it, actually, why don't you just tell people who you are and what you do and a little bit about yourself so they have some context?
Sure. I work for an outfit called the Independent Women's Forum, which we work on a whole host of issues. The particular stuff that I work a lot on is, for example, the definition of sex under law. And by that, I don't mean intercourse. I mean men and women. And I have a lot of experience in like education policy. So that's been what I do, that and yelling on Twitter, which Brittany is much better than I am about paying herself out of the yell chamber. I enjoy it, but I treat it a lot like Crazy Taxi, by the way. Nothing on Twitter actually gets into my soul. I just treat it like I'm swerving, hitting things on purpose.
Yeah.
but that's a little bit about my background. And as for the culture war forcing you to care. Yeah. I mean, I think because the culture has pushed so far left over the last maybe 30 or so years in particular, I mean, there are longer roots of it, but let's say the last 30 years in particular, I think things are shifting so fast that you will ultimately, you can't really sit out the culture wars because they'll come through your door.
Mm-hmm.
I think our modern, and it's funny because we're going to be talking obviously about Dobbs and Roe v. Wade, and that almost seems like a throwback because the culture wars of the 90s and 2000s, I think were sort of more traditional in the sense that you have more trad religious folks on one side for the most part. You have kind of liberal secularism on the other side. And those issues tend to be like directly related, the culture war issues. Now, I feel like the culture war issues are things that people can't avoid, like what is being taught in your child's school.
Right.
And I think that is part of the reason. There is no real Benedict option, right? There is no removing yourself, I think, from these cultural battles. Every society has certain, sometimes unspoken, fundamental agreements about what good and bad are, what, you know, what the rules of the road are. And when some, at least one side, in my view, has totally thrown out, they're both the rules and the road, and then inverted the traditional American understanding of what's good and bad, then I think that's how we end up with this kind of like, not just multi-front, but endless fronts in the culture war. It seems like literally everything, anything and everything can become a part of the culture war because we're just so fundamentally divided. And I know you and I kind of disagree on this, but I think we are so fundamentally divided, even if the majority of people are not as divided, perhaps, as the elites, the people who are actually, who have access to the levers of power are so fundamentally divided that I don't see an end to this kind of culture war, rock'em sock'ems.
Yeah. I think I agree with you in that respect because I don't see any end in sight. And I guess the question I would have is, do you think there are really only two sides or are there more than one side to this? Is it just like at the end of the day, there are two sides? Because some people will be like, there's more than one side to this. There are many sides, but it feels very much like sometimes... like, I feel like I'm going to end up, my husband always jokes, you know, no matter what your team McConnell, whether you want to admit it or not, you know, he's like at the end of the day. And sometimes I feel like I'm going to show up and everyone's going to be like, you're pretty late to the Civil War, Bridge. Like, we always knew where you were. And I still don't feel that way. I still feel like I ricochet back and forth because sometimes I agree that the left obviously has more institutional power just all across the board. And seeing tech come down and seeing the way that these things are coordinated and they work together. And it feels often like I'm viewing, you know, what it must feel like to be completely powerless. And then on the other hand, there's some, I don't know, there will be moments where I'll see something coming from the right. I'm trying to think of a good example recently where the rhetoric is just so, feels so old fashioned and antiquated to me that I just don't even see how one more generation up it would even survive. It just feels like a dying ideology. And I just don't know. I don't always really know where I sit. You know, I feel still very kind of lost and alienated. And people will be like, we know what side you're on. And I'm like, well, okay, but I don't. I don't know that I'm of the left, but I don't feel of the right either.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a difference between disagreement over nuanced policy issues and disagreement on such a fundamental level that you disagree about the obligations of citizenship, right, for example, or the existence of a nation state. I think those things are much harder to resolve. That, for example, the American tradition over free speech, right? Mm-hmm. And there are definitely boundaries to free speech, even in the American tradition. It was so long ago that we had, you know, obscenity limits on free speech. And I think those are all within the sort of small L liberal canon. But when the boundaries of American politics, I'll put it this way, I think you saw a lot more sort of mixed up parties when things were less ideological, and when those fundamental premises weren't threatened, or those fundamental principles were not as threatened, right? So right. you had, for example, you know, all the way through the 60s and 70s, you had a lot of pro-choice Republicans and a lot of pro-life Democrats. And on that issue, I think, and we can talk about it, I think Roe v. Wade basically started the realignment to the point where it's now impossible, basically, to run for office for either one of those parties if you disagree with the party on that particular issue. Mm-hmm. I would say Democrats have been much harsher about enforcing that than Republicans. I mean, as recently as 2010, we had pro-choice Republicans in California at the top of the ticket. But I understand the impulse to sort of return to normalcy, right? I too remember the 90s and 2000s, sort of shining time where we thought that we were having really substantial and deep political debates, but we really weren't in terms of, we had a lot of agreement on more fundamental principles. I also know that a lot of the things that we're experiencing now have definitely grown out of, they were in existence. It's just that they hadn't really come to institutional power.
Right.
So I would say a lot of this comes out of the New Left in the 1960s. And the difference isn't that Ibram Kendi is that much more left than, you know, his fellow radicals his comparative radicals in the 1960s or 70s. It's just that now Ibram Kendi owns not just the university, which the left has owned for a long time, but through the university owned K-12. And then from there, basically has taken over in newsrooms, in boardrooms, in, you know, the Fortune 500. That I think it's less that these ideas were not in existence in the 90s and 2000s, than they just simply didn't have yet the institutional power. And I see this very much as a sort of generational thing, where I definitely do see the sand on the time clock running out, because, you know, indoctrination works. Mm. You know, there are always exceptions, and there are always people who are sort of contrarian by nature, or they have some very strong impulses from their family or somewhere else contrary. But if you look at generational over time, like generational commitment to something like the principle of free speech, that's wildly different in millennials than it was in Gen X. And right. It's wildly different in Gen Z than it was in millennials, right? And that indoctrination works in that respect. And every year we're graduating graduation year of cultural revolutionaries into academia or into some of these more traditional left-wing places, like even media, but into, you know, the tech industry, right? So I think things will get worse before they get better.
Literally everyone on my podcast says this. I should have named my podcast "Things Will Get Worse Before They Get Better."
Yeah, I think there's like a sort of false sense of security or winning that we get from what I think are essentially the last Gen X defectors, right? So you have folks who I love and admire, like Barry Weiss or you know, Thomas Chatterton Williams or a lot of those folks in IDW, right? You have people defecting, mostly Gen X and older millennials, defecting from institutions that have been taken over by the hard woke left. But if you compare the younger folks in those institutions and their views to essentially their supervisors, there's a huge gap. And you know what? Eventually those kids are going to be the supervisors next, right? So I think what we're seeing is sort of the older folks who did not go through a truly 60s radical controlled education system, essentially saying, whoa, 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 whoa. Like this is too far. I consider myself a liberal. I'm not perhaps part of the moral majority from the 90s, but hold up, like this is going way too far. This is extreme. And I think we're getting kind of a sense of false security from that, because there seems like so many reasonable people are suddenly waking up to, oh, this is a danger. Mm-hmm. But the reality is this is like a generational turnover, and we haven't done anything institutionally to stop that kind of acceleration of more and more people into all of these different institutions. And mm-hmm. when you're in a hole, the first thing to do is stop digging. And we haven't stopped digging.
Yeah. That's something that Abigail Schreier actually, I think, is pretty on point about all the time. And she had a great tweet where she said, if you are waiting for the tide to turn, you're waiting to lose, basically, because she's like, I think she sees, first of all, on the ground, I think she sees a lot more. Her inbox is just a flood of real life ramifications of a lot of the stuff that's happening from all over the country. And so she has a different perspective on this, where people are like, the tide is turning. And it's like, no, it you might think it's turning, but it's actually getting worse. So
to put one concrete example, and I won't use names, but I have a friend who has a daughter who is caught up in exactly what Abigail Schreier has written about, right? The irreversible damage. She's caught up in sort of this trans social contagion. And this friend of mine is having enormous difficulty even finding a pediatrician who won't affirm her daughter.
Yeah, they can't. I mean, they'll lose their license.
In some cases, but in others, it's just like, it's two things, right? It's these choke points, credentialing choke points. In medicine, it's like things like the ABA and the diagnostic manual. But it's also the fact that younger doctors have all gone through university and medical school that was already controlled by people who very much embrace these ideas. And so that's how they learned medicine too. Mm-hmm. So it's just like a small example. Even 2 years ago, that was much less the case. So yeah, we have defectors. We have great folks like Barry and Abigail who are coming, you know, over from perhaps the Abigail is kind of, I would say she holds her politics close to the vest, or at least before this very much, you know, she was just really a reporter. But, you know, Barry very firmly to me seems center left. Maybe some people she's center right, but she's certainly not like conservative, movement conservative or traditionalist. Or folks who are even more liberal, I would say, who have come over. I think it's kind of a false sense of security from the intellectual center left that has sort of created this nice space. But the reality is all of these institutions are woker than they were 2 years ago. And 2 years ago, they'll be woker than they are right now.
2 years from now.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I feel like sometimes that's true and sometimes not. Even just today, I was reading that in San Francisco, they overturned that. You know, they had the school where they weren't allowing kids in by merit. I can't remember the name of the school right now. And then they overturned that because they replaced their whole board and threw them out. So I feel like that's a concrete example of how institutionally people are pushing back and saying, no, we're not just going to let a lottery system into this. We're still going to accept kids on merit. And that will remain the tradition. But what happens to people like Barry? What happens to people, you know, what happens to all of us who are kind of maybe partaking in this false sense of security? I would say I was a very early defector in the future. You know, where are we 5 years from now?
Well, I think that to the extent that it's possible to stop a lot of this, it is through the application of hard political power. And that doesn't mean authoritarian political power, but it means moving, you know, recognizing that these institutions are what they are, instead of pretending to accord honors and respect institutions that have long since lost it or long since earned the disrespect and lack of trust that they have among the American people now. And that's not just conservatives, right? But I think it will require, I'll put it this way, if we don't use the political power that we have now in a strategic way, and an institutional way, and I'm happy to talk through some examples of that, but I'm thinking just on the strategic level now, I think every, let's say, 2 to 5 years that goes by, the possibility of stopping this within a liberal system, like in the most broad sense, gets lessened, right, over time. In other words, the solutions will be more and more radical the longer this goes on, and the more people get pushed to the wall. And that's why I get very frustrated with people in the middle and who I would consider in the middle, who are the sort of establishment Republicans, because they think that they have another, you know, 15 years and that this is a passing phase or fad and that it's going, you know, it's going to return to independently to 1990. And I think Abigail Schar's actually had a great Substack piece about this, where she basically said, this won't stop until it's stopped. Right.
Right.
We have political levers to stop it, you know, in, for example, in higher ed, like we have enormous federal leverage over universities. Almost all of them are completely dependent on federal student loans in order to operate their budgets, right? Like there are all kinds of sort of policy solutions that could be applied here to create institutional disincentives against this. But I haven't seen any willingness in the mainstream Republican Party to actually, I guess, let me revise that. I see on the one hand, a lack of willingness and a lack of understanding of the problem this late in the game, which I find very inexcusable. I feel like you should just open your eyes and look around and see that this is not a passing fad, that it is a real threat to the American way of life, the way that we understand it. And then on the other hand, in the new right, sometimes, even though I align much more closely with their goals, sometimes it's being a total outsider. You come in with no understanding of like how to push policy levers to get what you want. And some of their policy proposals are just dumb. I listen to some of the stuff. I'm like, you're not going to get what you want. You're not, this is either going to be ineffective or like it's going to be run over in 2 years. And this is not an example of a dumb policy. This is a good policy. I'm actually in favor of it, but the sort of faith placed in it, I think I dissent from, which is, for example, banning critical race theory in schools, in public schools. I think it's totally within the power of the state legislature to set the curriculum. In fact, they have been setting the standards and curriculum forever. It's just that everybody suddenly woke up when they did it, did it this time. Mm-hmm. So I don't have any like small L liberal objection the way that, for example, Camille and David French and whoever else was on that, Jason Stanley was on that New York Times op-ed, making essentially the argument that this is illiberal. I don't think it's illiberal. I just think it's going to get completely, not to get all zen about this, but like, you know, like the single rock in the stream, it's going to be completely sort of routed around by a bureaucratic and educational system that is going to find new terms for things, is going to find different ways to introduce similar ideas into the curriculum. Fundamentally, you're trying to implement a rule in a system, and a system run by people who hate you, and the goals that you're trying to accomplish, like, you're not going to be very successful long-term in accomplishing that, because you can't sustain the level of activism necessary when the other side is a bunch of like full-time paid bureaucrats to oppose you in a thousand ways. I think that is probably, that's why, for example, I'm very much in favor of universal school choice. And I think one of the only things, and that's a liberal solution, right? It's yeah. A small L broad, I'm not mean like left liberal. I mean, like it's a liberal solution. But my bet there is just basically the average parent is a lot less woke than the average public school. Therefore, you know, giving them more accountability, more control, and more leverage, even within the public school, the leverage that's given to middle-class parents when they can take a meeting, for example, with the principal or the school board and say, well, we collected 50 people or 100 people who feel the same way as us, and we're all walking. If you don't take our concerns seriously, and that's, you know, millions of dollars off your budget.
Yeah.
That's just a very different meeting. It's a very different meeting than right now, where people are like, yeah, okay, that's nice. You can yell. Maybe you'll be able to occasionally chuck somebody out of the school board, but there's no direct accountability for making parents mad in the public school. So it's not that the solutions right now, I think we do have good liberal solutions for some of this, not all of it, but for some of it. But I think that window is closing. And to continue on the one example briefly, on school choice, you know, right now, people with school age kids are elder millennials and Gen X. When the average parent was born in 2000 and is already kind of imbibed these ideas on average through school and university, then the average like school choice will still be good in terms of, you know, I think there'll be a competitive quality effect, but it won't be a victory against like sort of woke institutions anymore, because the people making the choices, the parents, they won't be as horrified by this stuff as this current generation of parents is.
Right.
I'd like to take a quick break so we can talk about our sponsor.
If you enjoy Walk-In's Welcome with our variety of guests, we think you'll really enjoy the Jordan Harbinger Show. Recently, he sat down with Anya Shortland. She's a professor of political economy at King's College London, and she specializes in the economics of crime. This episode was fascinating. She's the author of Kidnap: Inside the Ransom Business. They discuss how many people are kidnapped every year for ransom and how many actually return from the ordeal alive, and what incentives kidnappers have to treat hostages nonviolently. Just such a cool episode. He also spoke recently with Bill von Hippel, professor of psychology at the University of Queensland and author of The Social Leap. They talk all about what our eyes tell us about how humans evolved to cooperate with one another, why so many of us hate the way we look in photographs, can animals lie, and so much more. Such fascinating, interesting guests. We love this show, and we think you will as well. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show, that's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
In terms of feeling like it's not sustainable for kind of this American way of life is something that you said. And in what respect are you talking just about the fundamental beliefs that we used to kind of share about what make up our country, like free speech and a Supreme Court and you know, different branches of government?
Yes, all of that stuff, but also the deeper you know, for example, the deeper premise that the American system is good, that it's far from perfect, but it has created probably the system with the most liberty, the most prosperity, you know, the most human flourishing that imperfect human beings have ever had, you know, the advantage of being born into. That's something that you can't get. You could not get a major, I bet you could not get a single Fortune 500 company to put out a statement like that. Who would do that? Who would say that the American system is good, even with the caveat that it's not perfect, even with the way that we used to, or for that matter, what Fortune 500 company would put out a statement that colorblindness is the goal. Perhaps we're not there yet or whatever caveats you want to put on there, but that the goal ought to be that we treat each other without regard to racial background and we treat each other purely on merit. What Fortune 500 company would put out a statement to that effect today?
Mm-hmm. No one.
That's what I mean by fundamental disagreement.
Yeah, there. I was laughing because I went on Twitter today after the Roe v. Wade was overturned and Death to America was trending. And I was like, oh, ISIS must be tweeting. And it was like, oh, no, this is the left.
Was that ISIS?
It was like the left wing was like, burn it all down. And I was laughing because it's like Death to America is something I associate with like foreign terrorists. And it was like my own people screaming Death to America, to your point. And there does seem to be that. I mean, I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, maybe in a check-in, but it struck me this past 4th of July. I was at the Hollywood Bowl and this woman kind of whispered to me. I was like dressed up in American flag pants and I had all this patriotic, you know, clothing on. And she was like, can I ask you a question? She's like, are you? And I thought she was going to ask me if I was pregnant, but she was like, are you a conservative? And I started laughing and I was like, why would you ask me that? And she said, I don't see young people expressing patriotism at all. So she just automatically assumed that because I was young and wearing patriotic stuff, I was a conservative. And
hey man, in my 30s, I'm just glad that if anybody calls me young, I get all excited.
I know. Yeah.
No, but I have to tell you, I have a corresponding story to that, which is, you know, the Bay Area in California where I grew up, I think has been where the left is now for a long time. So I actually grew up in, people talk about, for example, unity after 9/11, and I believe it happened, but that's not how I remember it. It really didn't happen where I came from. And after 9/11, people started putting everybody who was sort of not necessarily conservative, but like an objector, right? People started putting little American flags on their cars as a way, it was almost like a secret symbol, like, oh, you're one of them. You're one of us. Like it was almost like you're communicating to each other in a very subtle way, because to your point, these folks on the left would never consider putting an American flag on their car, something that should be a totally politically neutral statement. Or I don't even want to use the word neutral, but bipartisan or you know, non-ideological statement.
That happened in LA after all of the BLM protests and riots. Like all of a sudden, American flags started going up and it was a weird kind of silent communication of like, I'm not okay with this. Like people would kind of walk by and like nod at each other. It was a weird way of communicating. Like, I still believe in this country and this experiment, because so much of the language was just throwing out the baby with the bathwater. But speaking of babies and throwing out the baby. I didn't mean that, but I do want to get to it because I know we could probably talk for hours and I'll probably have you back to talk about this stuff because I just appreciate your mind and perspective on all of these issues. Even if I'm not completely kind of radicalized yet, I will be like the last person at the, you know, showing up to the Civil War, like, I'm here, guys. And they'll be like, yeah, we know. No shit, idiot.
I'll save you a pair of combat boots.
No shit, Bridget. We've known that for like 10 years.
That's what I wonder, though, is just is it just going to completely split? Like, are these people like Barry and the people that you would call defectors? Myself is probably included in that. Do we end up, because the thing is, like, the left won't have me anyway. They just won't have me because I'm talking to you, because I've talked to Ben Shapiro. They wouldn't even consider. I would be like, all right, guys, I'm here to fight. And they'd be like, get out of here. They'd kill me. So when I consider it from that perspective, I'm like, it is kind of a funny, funny thing to think that there is even a center. But I do actually believe there is a center of people who don't feel, they feel alienated by both of, particularly like the extremes on both parties. And I actually think this is very true around the abortion debate. I find that when I sit down and have conversations with many people about this kind of thing, it seems like a complicated moral issue. And a lot of people can understand that legally that this really didn't necessarily have legs when it was, you know, passed or whatever. And then they also have complicated feelings about when life starts and all these things. So can you explain why you believe, because you said to me earlier in text that you think this is a win for democracy, you know, a good day. Can you explain why you believe and feel that way?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that in the age of the culture wars, right, we have fewer and fewer issues that we can actually vote on. Right. So in many ways, the story of the 20th century is the story of the expansion of the franchise. Right. So you have more and more people being given the franchise, the vote. Right. And at the same time, over the last century, I almost feel like democracy is being squeezed, or the political process is being squeezed from two sides. One is the administrative state, which is, you know, growing and making ever more important decisions. And as evidence that proposition, I'll point to the Biden administration Title IX regs that just dropped on Thursday, the day before Dobbs, right? No grand fanfare for them, but they redefine sex to include gender identity, right, for every school in America. And they roll back due process guarantees that the Supreme Court has actually said exist, their constitutional rights. So they cut seriously into due process constitutional rights. And finally, they cut into free speech substantially by allowing universities to broaden out the definition of harassment to the point that they were doing before, which is the point where a professor from Northwestern was slapped with a Title IX suit for writing a piece about sex roles that was published, right? And that was sexual harassment under Title IX, or that's clearly an expansion into speech and not conduct, right?
Is it true too that if you don't use someone's pronouns, it's considered sexual harassment?
Yeah. So, or discrimination on the basis of gender identity.
And
right?
where would that be applied? In schools?
Every school that takes, so that's what these regs are, every school that takes a federal dollar, which is virtually, obviously every public K-12 school, mm-hmm. and then virtually every university all the way up from, you know, to grad schools, law schools, medical schools, right? So almost every university takes federal money via student loans and grants. So Hillsdale and like Bob Jones University, I think, are the only two.
Yeah.
So like, they're all subject to this. But yeah, so that's a sweeping regulation that nobody voted. Not only we didn't vote on, but we didn't vote for anyone, right? So this is coming out of a bureaucratic institution, agency, the Department of Education. Nobody voted for these people, but here they are promulgating these regulations.
This happens all the time in LA with like our LA County making all of these mandates that we had to abide by during the pandemic by literally the most unhealthy person. The person who makes these regulations looks like a ghost. She looks like she came back from the crypt and she's dead, and she's like our health regulator.
Yeah. No, I mean, we should all be super familiar after the pandemic with rule by bureaucrat. I mean, we bypassed all the normal legislative process. But so that's one side of this, like fewer and fewer things are left untouched by bureaucrats. And then on the flip side, for the last 50 years, you've had a court that has weighed in well beyond what is enumerated in the Constitution or what can be supported by a more rigorous application of what the words in the Constitution mean. And that has been an enormous detriment to democracy. Like the last 50 years, we should have been having this debate about abortion on the state level. And that entire debate was short-circuited in 1973 by the Supreme Court, by unelected judges who stepped beyond their bounds to do so. And it's not just the right that thinks that. I mean, famously, although she repeatedly as a justice upheld precedent under Roe and Casey, but even when Ruth Bader Ginsburg was a academic, she wrote about the weakness of this decision. There really isn't a legal justification. All of the justifications are working backwards. They're working backwards from the policy outcome they want. So when I say it's a win for democracy, I think it is. I think it is good for the American people to exercise what are increasingly atrophied muscles of self-government. And look, in New York, that's going to look like, and California, it's going to look like just as extreme sort of abortion laws as we have. And they are extreme, both in reference to the American people who tend to be more or less pro-choice through the first trimester and pro-life second and third, with exceptions and so on. But those basic numbers have held for quite some time. So our abortion regime, in terms of Roe and Casey, was far to the left of where the American people are on it, and also far to the left of most countries, for example, in Europe.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a good thing that we will return. Like, will there be some states like, you know, Alabama that decide to put in laws from conception, criminalizing abortion from conception? Probably. But that's probably because the majority of people in Alabama believe that that should be the law. And then, you know, in New York and California, it's going to stay very, very liberal. And I imagine that a lot of the states in between will shake out somewhere in the middle. So the law at issue in Dobbs is from Mississippi, and it's a ban after 15 weeks.
Right. You know that I didn't know you could get an abortion after the first trimester until I got caught in the crossfire of the culture wars. When I grew up, I thought it was always like you had to get it done in the first 3 months, and 12 weeks is what I thought it was. So I didn't know that there were places you could, you know, when I was like, when people were like, no, you can get up to 20 weeks. I'm like, 20 weeks? That's like, no. But I have complicated feelings about all of this, because obviously there's a weird thing about my body being litigated that I just intuitively react to, where it makes me feel like out of control or powerless, even though it's not me specifically in California. I'm using me as like a woman. It just makes me feel like a second class citizen or something, where the choices you have the ability to make over your body being, it just seems very strange to me, even though I know it's not, and it's probably a totally emotional reaction. On the other hand, when the 6-week ban came down in Texas, I was 6 weeks pregnant and had just seen the heartbeat. And it is unquestionable that that is a life inside of me that, you know, left untouched, I think, is going to be a person that, you know, the argument, I guess, is that being has rights as well, even maybe more so because they're so vulnerable. And I don't know, being pregnant, I also know what it does to your body and your health and your pocketbook and your ability to work. And I have very, very mixed feelings about forcing that on anybody. Women in particular, obviously women. And generally, I think it will probably affect women who don't have as many resources to even provide the child with a good life or education, so, or anything. So I feel like I have so many competing and mixed feelings on the moral aspect. And then from the legal perspective, it seems like I don't fully understand what substantive due process is. Can you explain what that means? Because it seems like now they're saying like all of these rulings that were made under this substantive due process should be reversed or overturned.
I mean, when you say explain what substantive due process is, you know, I think you say that rightly, because it sounds like nonsense, because it is. So the idea is that the due process clause in the 14th Amendment inherently contains within it certain rights, substantive rights. So not, I would think, like a person who reads the word process, that, in fact, this refers to things like what the Title IX regs just ate into, right? You know, if you're accused of something, you have a right to impartial adjudicator. You have the right to, you know, present evidence in your defense, for example. Like, these are process questions. Substantive due process is, okay, there are some substantive rights that are so fundamental that we pull them out of a hat under due process. And we say that there is no way to have given somebody due process. And so in this case, what I would say is the process that's due is the political process, right? Because this is the heart of criminal law. It always has been the heart of criminal law. And actually, so I also oppose federal efforts by Republicans to legislate on the issue of abortion on the federal level. It seems pretty clear to me that in every other case, unless you're saying the unborn baby is a judge or some kind of federally connected official, there are some cases more practically, some cases about crossing state lines. But, you know, we have allowed the states to continue to have their traditional power of making criminal law. And even with regard to something that somebody considers murder. So, for example, in California, right, you have very limited self-defense defense, right? If you kill somebody, it's really hard to prove that you did it for self-defense. You have like a high standard for that. In Texas, if somebody comes on your property, you can kill them, right? At self-defense. So you could theoretically have the exact same killing. And in Texas, that guy walks, doesn't even get charged probably, right? But if he is charged with murder, he walks because he presents a self-defense case. Guy was on my property, right? In that same case in California, that guy is sentenced as a murderer. So do we protect life differently under the criminal law in our states? Yes, we do. And I don't support the idea that Congress can come in and enshrine the, for example, the California standard for every state. So the abortion, like all criminal law, I think should very much be in the state level. But to answer a little bit about like the framing that you have about the issue itself. So I've one thing to say that is probably something that I think you'll like and something else that maybe you won't as much. And one is that you said there are sort of, you're listing that it's difficult, that there are women, you don't want to force them to bear a child and raise the child, right? Given how genuinely difficult that is on your body and your life and your pocketbook, as you said. So I object to the word force because, except in the case of rape, and this is not just a responsibility argument, actually, it's the opposite. It's the natural consequence of things. Mm-hmm. It's not, you know, imposed by some, you know, angry cishet white men or whatever it is. That is actually the natural consequence of sex, right? And so I sort of object to the framing of it as forced. But the other thing is that, you know, this legitimately is a complicated moral question, because in no other instance that I can think of, these are two rights that we rightly consider very fundamental, right? One is life. That one's pretty simple, even if it's not simple as applied to like gestational age or whatever. But usually in all cases, you know, outside the womb, we all recognize like you can't just kill somebody. The state should do something about that, right?
Yeah.
And on the other hand, we all recognize, I mean, that people have bodily autonomy.
Right.
And we would rightly be horrified if somebody, for example, received, and maybe not these days, received medical intervention, right? Because we do hold that right as very fundamental, something very close to the heart of liberty, that if you can't, you know, be sovereign over your body, what kind of liberty do you have?
Mm-hmm.
And pregnancy is the only time in human life where those two things are potentially at odds.
Mm.
Right. Yeah. It's a unique question. It's a unique moral question. And I don't like it. Something I dislike from the left and the right on this, I dislike on the left, the sort of callousness.
Yeah, the shout your abortion.
Yeah, the shout your abortion as though, you know, anybody but a tiny minority of women ever experience abortion that way, as though it's like clipping your fingernails, right?
Yeah. I hate that. I think it's undermined the whole movement or whatever it is. I think it undermines their... I agree. It's not really how most women experience it. And I think it ignores the challenge most women have in making the decision to have an abortion if they choose to have one. And I also think it acts like people are skipping down the street to just have an abortion after they went to the bar, like it's no big deal. And it makes it seem, it's like ghoulish. You know, there's something... it's turned me off from the pro-choice. It turns me away from the pro-choice movement in a way that I find offensive. It's like, it's offensive to me that they would just be so, like you said, callous about it.
Yeah. That on the flip side though, the right is not in some ways wants to brush the liberty concern under the rug. Right. And the fact remains that, you know, and like I said, in every other instance, we would be horrified to take somebody's bodily autonomy away with regard to like medical intervention, for example, or like things that really affect their person, right?
Well, this is where I think the vaccine mandates and the push for that has undermined it as well. You know, their whole my body, my choice message.
Maybe we've jettisoned that entirely at this point, but
yeah,
you know, there's still a presupposition in our society that we do have bodily autonomy. And I think it's sometimes the right doesn't acknowledge that enough. Like they pretend to not see the liberty concern here. And I understand perfectly the pro-life argument, which is, you know, life trumps liberty, right? Mm-hmm. This is a unique instance where you have to acknowledge that there are two persons involved here, not one. And you don't get to take somebody's life as part of your liberty, even if it is a huge imposition. That's all the violinist arguments from Thompson and all that stuff. But I think that is somewhat unacknowledged. I actually think the sort of pragmatic concerns are acknowledged by the right. You know, the right is contrary to the way that the left talks about it. You know, I think there are a lot of people on the right who are very invested in, you know, trying to help young mothers with, you know, in a bad situation.
I think motherhood in general too, and all mothers, I don't necessarily see either side really. I think the left seems almost, I don't know, they seem to like look down on motherhood in some weird way, or just not be supportive of it from an idea perspective, but maybe in their rhetoric, like, oh, we need to support these moms. But I think just, I'd love to see more support for mothering and motherhood in general from everybody in the country on both sides. Even just having a baby and seeing just how, I'm like, how do we not have better support for women after they have kids? Just all women. It doesn't matter. So that they can be with their baby and take time off work and heal their body. This seems like something that's, if we're going to, I don't know, it just seems very important to, I'm like, I'm a single issue person now. And it's like, help moms get some maternity leave. I don't know. It just seems like the moms aren't supported in general.
So on the question of maternity leave, so two things, just dividing this up morally, the answer, and this is, I'm just making the pro-life argument now. The answer to any of the material deprivation questions cannot be to, like, you know, to kill the innocent, mm-hmm. right? So that's why I don't find these arguments convincing with regard to abortion. Now, taking them on the merits, right? For example, IWF actually has had for a long time, and Rubio proposed something similar to this, but has had a proposal that would allow people to essentially put off retirement by a year or 6 months or however long they want, and to take Social Security essentially as maternity leave. So, you know, anyway, we're in a time where most of us, or at least fewer of us, are not working high labor jobs where we have to retire at 65. And if people want to work until, you know, 67 and take, you know, have maternity leave essentially twice to have two kids and be paid their Social Security payout earlier in life, that would, at a time where they really need it. Like, so we're very supportive of those kinds of proposals.
Isn't Social Security going to be bankrupt?
Well, in this case, it actually is. So yes. and there are adjustments that need to be made to Social Security based on the fact that, like, when we put Social Security together, people were having like four or five kids and they were dying at 70. Mm-hmm. And now people are having one or two kids and they're dying at 85. Mm-hmm. And the numbers just don't work. So I would say probably have to look at raising the retirement age more generally. Or at least selectively, or look at means testing or something. So this solution would not touch that problem either way, right? It's like a budget neutral solution.
Right.
And I think it allows people flexibility to take the money that they are already owed, right, in a time in their life where they really need it. But mm-hmm. I do think there's fundamentally no way to solve the tension between, like, the fact is, and obviously lots of women balance this admirably, but raising a child is a huge job. Yep. And having a job is a job.
Yeah.
And fundamentally, there's always going to be attention there. And that's why, I mean, even Sheryl Sandberg, right? She's famously lean in, except now she's dropped out, right?
Yeah.
I think the era of the have it all girl boss and the imagination that that is actually a possibility for most women, I think is really has been taking hits for a long time, but it's now, I think the pandemic kind of killed off that notion that you can have it all the time within the same time frame. I think there's an almost necessary trade-off. Now, that doesn't mean that women don't work at all. It doesn't mean that, you know, there isn't some kind of balance to be had, but you know, there's a reason that consistently in surveys, most women say their ideal work is part-time when their children mm-hmm. are young.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't enough hours in the day to do all those things well. And usually one or the other suffers. And on the flip side, I don't think it's fair to like expect companies to make up that difference unless it's part of a sort of voluntary package where they're like, okay, essentially we get your work for this number of years and we're essentially willing to cover you for this period. But I don't think it's a really fair solution to say, because of the inevitable trade-offs of life, the company now owes women that balance in a way. I think that's
yeah. kind of yeah, that's why I guess I feel like it should fall on the country. Like it does for my cousin in Germany. You know, she got a year off and her husband got 9 months, and it seems like, but that was supported by Germany, not by their companies weren't making up that difference.
I mean, but also all European countries, including Germany, heavily, heavily tax the middle class for those
right.
benefits. Like it's not something you can sort of tack on a small tax onto the uber wealthy the way that, for example, right. Liz Warren pretends it can be, right? Look, there are decisions to be made as a society. France has a huge social safety net. They also take home, like I was talking to a friend of mine a few years ago in France, and he got about 35% of his take home.
Yeah, it's
like,
crazy.
Like as in his paycheck was 35% of his salary.
I know. I was talking to my therapist about this today because she's Dutch, and she was like, they have roads and they have this. And she's like, you know, I get taxed and I don't know where it goes here. And I'm like, yeah, but you're not getting taxed what you get taxed over there. I was like, try and double it, because she's not in California. She's somewhere where she's certainly not getting taxed like 50, 60% of her wages. So, yeah, I mean, their quality of life she might have health insurance and nice roads and high quality of life and whatnot, but she's not going to be taken home anywhere near what she is now.
You know, my objection to this kind of European safety net system is actually less about dollars and cents than it is about when I realized that, because that was what my friend said back. He was like, okay, well, I take only 35% of my pay home, but you know, I don't have a healthcare bill. I don't have and leaving aside all questions of actual efficacy and the quality of the healthcare and all this, just shove all that to the side. He was like, you know, my housing is subsidized. My, you know, university tuition is paid for. I don't have all these bills. So like, he's like, yeah, I only take home 35%, but what I have to pay for that is basically the leftover of my subsidized rent and like my groceries and, you know, my bill in the cafe. And it suddenly struck me that that's kind of like living like a child forever. You know, that's how I think about it. Like, I don't want to be treated by the government where they just like, they're like, you are not wise enough to make decisions on your own about paying for things, which many of us are not, let's be honest. But still, I think at some point you have to fundamentally be treated as an adult with responsibilities and not be just given an allowance for the cafe. You know?
That's actually really funny. That's how they all live, though.
Yeah, they're all on allowance.
Yeah.
Like they get a certain percentage of their income for allowance, and the state makes the decisions about the rest of their income and puts it into, quote unquote, what they ought to be spending on.
They seem okay with it, though, for the most part.
Yeah. Look, there are lots of different ways, you know, countries have arranged it. And, you know, most of them are, actually, I would say all of them are imperfect and suboptimal. But I would not want to live in a country where the society and government treats me essentially like a you know, 15-year-old where I get my allowance to hit up the vending machine.
To go on vacation and chill yeah. in the cafe and go see some music, go see some musicians. Well, so I was reading
to go back to the substantive due process, can you explain how, from a legal perspective, the kind of seeds for this being overturned were sown in the original decision?
So there had been a right to privacy. And this is why people say that there are connections between this case and some of the other cases. So I can never say this. Obergefell. I can't say that guy's name. I wish the person who had taken us to court had a more pronounceable name. And then Lawrence in 2005 and Griswold, which deals with birth control, which is a little older. But so the original one was Griswold. Oh, maybe I'm wrong about this. It's been a while since I've been in law school, but I think the original one is Griswold, and it establishes some form of right to privacy. But in that context, right, it was about married couples using contraception. And the kind of principle behind this right to privacy was almost kind of rooted in the Fourth Amendment, right, against search and seizure. It was like nobody should be coming into your house and checking whether or not you have a condom while you're screwing, right? Mm. There is some, it seems to be some fundamental constitutional violation involved in, and they spun something like a right to privacy out of this due process clause. To the extent that a right to privacy exists under the Constitution, I would prefer to locate it in the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which is, by the way, what Justice Thomas's concurrence in Dobbs leaves open or sort of puts to the court as a future avenue for these kinds of cases. But yeah, I mean, so out of that right to privacy came a secondary right to privacy, which was based on bans on sodomy, right? So Lawrence is a case that deals with sodomy and prosecution of what has been, since the beginning of the country and in many other countries, an illegal activity on the state level. And fortunately, I don't think we're really going to see that go anywhere, just because no state in 2022 would ban sodomy. Mm-hmm. There isn't one that would do it. So I don't see a basis really for that to get challenged. But overall, this kind of substantive due process was taking issues out of the political realm and putting them into the Supreme Court. And whether you agree or disagree, and I would say, for example, I agree that sodomy should not be illegal. I agree that birth control should be legal for adults, right? Those are, to my mind, good policy outcomes, but I do believe they were bad law. These are not things that are in our Constitution. And in fact, for all the time up to these decisions, they had not been considered to have constitutional implications. And despite the fact that, for example, in the abortion case, I think at the time Roe was decided, 49 states out of 50 had abortion regulations on the books that violated the Roe standard, right? So I think New York is the only one that didn't have those restrictions. So that doesn't mean that every state banned abortion from conception, but every state except for New York had some kind of regulation of abortion that Roe ultimately overturned. So it's very difficult. If you go back, even when the 14th Amendment was ratified, there were a bunch of states that also had legislation around abortion, although it was just not thought of as much then because it wasn't regulable in the same way because it wasn't really medicalized. But so there were states with laws against abortion on the books, and nobody at the time thought that the 14th Amendment had anything to do with that. It was very clearly aimed at providing the rights of citizenship to newly freed slaves. So I think that I'm with this Justice Thomas concurrence here, because this is one of the only changes between the leaked opinion in Dobbs and the opinion that ultimately went forward. Obviously, Justice Roberts joined and made it 6-3, although he has his own concurrence as well. But I'm pretty sure because of that, there's a paragraph in it that is not in the leaked opinion. And it basically carves out abortion from those other cases I mentioned, from Lawrence, from Griswold, and from Obergefell, or from the gay marriage case. Uh-huh. It carves out and it says abortion is a sort of an act with unique implications, both legally and morally. And this decision should not be considered sort of an overturning of this or a reopening of this entire substantive due process line of cases. Justice Thomas's concurrence says, no, that actually doesn't make any sense legally. If you are saying that this method of establishing quote unquote new rights is not legally legitimate, then we should be open to reconsidering these cases. And then he says, and see if any of these rights could actually be found in the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which is like the privileges and immunities of citizenship. So he's proposing an alternate basis for some of them and perhaps not all, but saying, to the extent that we think these are fundamental rights that are protected by the Constitution, they were still wrongly decided, and we need to look for those rights elsewhere in the Privileges and Immunities Clause. So I'm very much, unsurprisingly, I'm very much with Justice Thomas on this. And I think there will end up being future tension on the court between this Justice Thomas' concurrence that actually does challenge the entire basis of substantive due process. And the majority opinion of the court, with which Roberts and Thomas both concurred in judgment, but the majority opinion of the court that Alito wrote with this extra paragraph, basically trying to cabinet off and say, we're not going to consider any more implications of due process. We shouldn't consider this case Dobbs to apply to any of these other cases. We say abortion is its own thing legally, and we'll have to cabinet out from all these other cases.
I still feel like a dummy who doesn't understand what substantive due process is. I still just am like, it doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't make sense. You're not alone. It's literally, basically the idea is that there are some rights that no process could ever, they're so fundamental that no process could ever be fair to remove them, right? So, but that's obviously not true. We put people in jail.
Okay.
You know, if you rape somebody and are convicted of rape, you have the due process of going through your trial, right? And we have standards for how we determine guilt from innocence. But ultimately, if you are convicted, your liberty is taken away and you are imprisoned. So the idea is, under substantive due process, is like
game
no process that could possibly be fair if you take away people's liberty. But obviously that's not true.
So in the context of abortion or gay marriage, that you can't even litigate these things, or it's not even something that you apply due process to?
I think the idea is that if a state passes a law that restricts, let's say, your right as a gay couple to get married, that right is so fundamental, you have essentially been denied due process, even though this has nothing to do with process. It's like a substantive thing. You know what I'm saying? Like, this, either this right exists or it doesn't. But the substantive due process cases essentially say, well, there are some rights that we're just pulling out of a hat, that there's no process that could possibly satisfy these due process protections.
Okay.
Whereas the understanding before that was, yeah, the process, quote unquote, that was due is the legislative process. Like, you can't just like randomly go around, you know, like locking women up and preventing them from getting abortions. You have to go through the legislative process and get citizens to vote or not, right? And the representatives to vote or not. And then it's promulgated just like any other law. That's the way that any other law comes into being. But the idea of substantive due process is that that's not enough process. And in fact, there can never be enough process to pass a law regarding abortion.
Okay. And that's why you're glad that this is down something that people can vote again on.
Yeah,
I think
it's good that Americans, look, we just had this whole conversation about how this is a really profound moral issue with all these implications, both moral and practical. And I think the appropriate place to have those kinds of conversations is in the political process, as opposed to 9 justices deciding it for the country. There's nothing in the Constitution about abortion. So they stepped way beyond their bounds, basically went into the American people and took this issue like, yoink, took it out of their ability to decide for themselves through the process of self-government. And this is, to me, the perfect issue to decide through the process of self-government, because it's complicated, because it's difficult. So why, and it doesn't have any like particular legalese that would make it so that justices would be better at deciding that question than people themselves through the political process and democracy.
Yep, I see. It's starting to make some kind of sense to me. I was like, I don't understand. I feel like I'm an idiot when I'm trying to read about substantive due process.
It's contradictory. So yeah, it's like a bizarre, that's why a lot of scholars on the left also, like Akhil Amar, for example, who's probably the foremost scholar on the 14th Amendment. He's a guy of the left. I would say moderate left, but he is a guy of the left, and he's in favor of legalized abortion. I'll put it that way. And he also thinks that this is the right decision. So, I mean, legally, you used to get a lot more, especially if you get people off the record, if you get a lot of like sort of legal scholars off the record, they will admit to you that substantive due process is a little bit of, I don't know if I can swear on this podcast, but it's a little bit of bullshit.
Yeah.
They'll admit it because it is.
Yeah, it's just now all of the hyperbole, as we'll see, it just gets so crazily heated immediately. And it's now conversation
people are having that they're going to have with each other. And I'm not looking forward to that. I guess it's like, it brings it out of just the shadows and into everyday conversations. And I think there's, it's so, so complicated and complex. I don't know. I'm not looking forward to, yeah. Right before we got to talking, I was like speaking with somebody and I just didn't even want to have the conversation with them about it. You know, I'm like, I don't want to even like get into this. And they were like, well, what do you think? And I'm like, I don't think anymore. I don't want to think anymore. And I just have so many mixed feelings about it. I don't even know how to parse my own feelings about it from an emotional level, let alone practical and legal. And I think that's the other thing that complicates it is there's the legal part of this and then the ethical and moral discussion that is far more complex. And I don't know that like the people are up to it right now. You know, it's seeing how divided and insane everyone is. This just feels like throwing gasoline on a fire. I'm like, oh good, this will calm things down.
Well, it definitely won't calm things down. I although in the long run it might, in the sense that people sort themselves into, and people tend to be less vociferous about injustices in their view that are occurring far away. But I guess I would say is that you are no less qualified to have thoughts and engage with this issue than, you know, Justice Thomas or any of the other justices on the court, right? There's nothing about being on the Supreme Court that makes them an expert on the moral question of abortion. Mm-hmm. And that is the essence of self-government, right? Like the default should be, we are engaged in this difficult and messy process of ruling ourselves, of mm-hmm. governing ourselves, right? And it's going to demand a lot from us, but that is the price we pay for living in a democracy. And it's, I'm not sort of daisy chain about this. I agree with you. I think we're not going to be, you know, we're not going to rise to this challenge with an enormous amount of nuance and understanding, right? I'm not, but that is literally what it means to be a citizen in a republic. Mm. And so I don't see why Justice Thomas or any of the other justices should have a monopoly on that issue. Like I, as much respect as I have for their intelligence and legal training, that this, there isn't anything in the Constitution that they're really applying here in a legitimate way. And therefore their power to do so, to take this away from us, is illegitimate fundamentally, right? As opposed to the things that are actually in the Constitution, which we all kind of agreed on in the beginning, and, you know, in subsequent generations, there's a debate to be had here about, you know, compact theory or whatever. But, you know, when they start pulling things out of the air because they think they're right, you know, this time it was abortion, but maybe it's like something else next time, right? It's something that the right loves and the left hates. And if they pull it out of thin air, then what they've done is deny us the opportunity as citizens to rule ourselves. And that's why I say I think it's a win for democracy.
I love that. I'd like to take a quick break so we can talk about our sponsor.
Watkins Welcome is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening to me talk, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. Getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save over $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at Progressive.com and join the over 27 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2020 and May 2021. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I always ask the same two questions at the end of my podcast. What is your biggest defect of character?
I didn't prepare for this. I never, even though I listened to your podcast, I did the same thing with Alex Bashuda. She always has this question at the end about reading. what do you, and I just like completely Sarah Palin'd out on her. She asked me like, all of the things. I don't know. This one's a little more personal. Greatest defect. I used to think that I was too sort of didactic or like morally black and white. I think I've improved somewhat on that in recent days, but now I worry that I am too prone to, no, you know what it is? Laziness. 100%. That's 100%.
You don't seem lazy to me.
I am lazy. I'm not intellectually lazy necessarily, but I'm definitely lazy. And sometimes that, what I worry about increasingly, especially as, you know, I also have a podcast and everything, and I talk to like really well-informed, smart people all the time. And
that's why I'll never be on it.
No, you have to come on it now. You are a well-informed, smart person.
No, but, I'm not.
I just feel like you are. I feel like sometimes my laziness is now getting in the way of my ability to like really ask these people the most complex questions and talk to them about things that are really important. So yeah, no, I'm working on it, but that's definitely, that is definitely my greatest defect, I think.
I feel like having a baby has made me more, not lazy. It's weird. It's just, I just want to hang out with her all day. I don't want to be engaged in, and maybe it'll pass. Like maybe as she gets older and gets more engaged in the world, then my brain will start coming back online. But I'm in a position where I still have to work. I was like, want to know how I'm working class still? I was working at 6 weeks postpartum. That's how you know. And it's probably good for me to engage my like pregnant brain. But I definitely feel like all I want to do is just focus on her. And I feel like it's in a weird way made me even lazier than I already felt.
I don't think that's laziness. I truly don't. I think that's just, you are focusing on something else. It's not lazy. I guarantee it. It's not lazy to take care of a baby. Baby demands a lot, right?
They do demand a lot.
That's not laziness. That's just focusing on one thing that sometimes actually to the extent, like if you're taking on a really big project, like raising an entire human life, then you just necessarily have to crowd out other things. So I don't think that qualifies as laziness. I think you have to come up with more defects.
What's your biggest asset?
I think I do strive to be good. I mean, I think sometimes that makes me morally didactic, but I don't know. I'm thinking about Anna Karenina because I just did a chat with PragerU on Anna Karenina, and Tolstoy essentially wrote himself into the novel as the character of Levin. And I think perhaps the thing I do like about myself, among many things that I don't, would be that, you know, it's not that Levin is, you know, sort of some great paragon of virtue, but he is trying, right? He's trying to discern what the good is, and then once discerning it, tries his best to uphold it, again, in an obviously like deeply imperfect way. But I do think I try, you know, I do try to understand the good better every day or every week or every month, and to try to actually back up that understanding with my action, imperfectly, obviously.
Well, I also think you really try to be intellectually honest. It's one of the reasons I really appreciate your takes all the time. Even if I'm not sure that I agree with them, I always understand how you came to the conclusion you came to. And it usually isn't just an emotional reaction. It seems like it's something you've really thought deeply about and weighed against other things. And so usually I'm like, I'm probably wrong about this. If I look at your take,
so.
But you're just, I really appreciate you out there. I love you so much, and just as a friend, but as somebody out there in the culture war, I appreciate your perspective, and I think it's necessary. So tell us where we can find your podcast, where you talk to very smart, informed people about things, and where we can find you.
You can find my podcast is called High Noon with Inez Stepman, and you can find that anywhere that you find podcasts. And you can find my work at IWF.org or my Twitter at Inez Belcher, F-E-L-T-S-H-E-R. That's my maiden name. You cannot change your name on Twitter. Once you get the blue check, they're going to take it away from you if you change your name. So I don't think they would reauthorize me. So I kept it the same. But you can look up Inez Stepman on just on Twitter. It should pop up.
Amazing. I thank you so much for your time and thank you for having this conversation with me today. I really needed to have it, even though I was like, oh man, when that came down, I'm like, how are we going to avoid talking about this? But I'm glad that I have someone like we've talked about this. It was early in our friendship. We were talking about this because I had never really had to consider anything other than the pro-choice, you know. That was just the like water I was kind of born into was pro-choice. So I was like, tra-da-da, that's just the way it goes. So it's been a journey for me. And I appreciate having you on it.
Well, I very much appreciate every chat with you, Bridget, even those on podcasts and those off. But I think such a profound moral question, if you are, and here I'm condemning, I guess, both sides, but if you are really certain about the status of abortion and you can't even, it's just such a profound moral question that, I mean, I'm certainly not certain about my conclusions on it. So I would encourage nobody to take me seriously on it. But yeah, I think it's a difficult question if you consider it seriously, it's a difficult question.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Thank you.
Thanks.
All this month, stream the funniest films for free on Pluto TV. Watch comedy classics like Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, and Mean Girls. Or drop in for a Tyler Perry marathon with a Madea family funeral and Madea's witness protection. Pluto TV also has hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and TV shows like Get Shorty, Be Cool, Key and Peele, Comedy in Color, and more. And no contracts, no subscriptions, no fees, no joke. So download the Pluto TV app on your favorite streaming device and start laughing today. Pluto TV, drop in, watch free.
It's time for the weekly check-in with Bridget and Cousin Maggie.
Wow.
Shocking.
We're shocked that our equipment works.
We spend 5 minutes fiddling with the mics to get them to work.
Honestly and truly. Our darns galore.
It's amazing we've come as far as we have.
We should be much farther.
I'm amazed. I was thinking the other day about, I'm amazed I'm not still waitressing.
I went over to my friend's house and I was walking up and had this moment of like feeling like the biggest loser of all of my friends.
Well, your friends are definitely like, you've got like a level up league of friends and I'm just kind of like do.
I can't even like, they all have houses in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just was like, I'm the biggest loser of all my friends. I'm like the poorest loser of the friend group.
Yeah. A lot of my friends have really high-powered jobs, like not in terms of, you know, like the entertainment industry kind of wealth, but just like, you know, master's degrees, like just very high-powered jobs, yeah, where doctorates and like all sorts of crap. And I'm always like, do.
I mean, honestly, we really should just be grateful that we're not waitressing.
Yeah, I was thinking about it yesterday.
You at least have a degree.
Only because I owed one to my parents.
I don't even have a degree. I've got nothing.
Yeah, but you're like the powerhouse behind it all. You're the one. You're the reason we're all here.
I mean, if we did the Pomodoro effect more often, we'd probably get more done.
It's true.
Yeah. Maggie reminded me today of a t-shirt idea we had.
It's on our list.
That's on our list. Babies, no thanks.
Well, she was sitting next to Matilda. Yep, she was like, just a t-shirt. Babies, no thanks.
It was just going to be like one of those warning labels that they have on things that are plastic, but that was going to be the design of just a baby with like a no.
With a red circle with a line through it, and then like, babies, no thanks.
Now I want to make it.
Yeah, no, we definitely have to make it now.
So I can wear it, ironically.
And we can take a picture of you looking exhausted with a screaming Matilda.
Because I'm still a child of the 90s, and I do like my ironic t-shirts.
There's nothing as great as a good ironic t-shirt.
There really isn't anything. Although I do like memes. I think memes are the ironic t-shirts of the 2020s.
There was that meme that Better Fantasy had on our like kindling list. I don't even know if you saw it, where it was like Bane. It was like boomers full of lead, and then this like little like dude in a pink onesie, like, and being like, what was it, like Gen Z full of microplastics. I was dying laughing.
Memes, I really think, and I was having a conversation in one of my group texts, well, they're really the only group text. No, there's a couple. We have the dumpster fire one. But we were talking about just how much we appreciate memes. Uh-huh. And just, I was saying, I think it's the digestive enzyme of the blob.
Yeah.
It is how you know it's been absorbed.
When the memes are outstanding.
Yeah. When the memes are out.
Uh-huh.
She's 2 months old.
Right now we were looking at pictures of how tiny she was.
She's in the 95th percentile of weight.
Oh, wow. She's really long, too.
No, she's only in the 50th percentile there.
Really?
She hasn't grown that much.
Huh.
Maybe she won't be at all.
At all.
She'll just be squat little fatty.
It's good you've started fat shaming her at 2 months old.
They were like, when she told me she was in the 95th percentile, I was like, should I stop feeding her as much? And she's like, yeah, we should put her on Weight Watchers. My doctor was like, no, it's fine. I didn't know. Like, maybe I'm feeding her too much.
She only gets breast milk.
She's like, they're very impressed with my breast milk.
Oh, yeah?
Apparently.
The quality or the amount?
She's chunka. She's like, wow, great breast milk. I'm like, thank you.
I've worked really hard on it. It's like, well, you're perfect nipples, too. You're just like a breast milk machine.
You were like, born. I should donate it.
You were born to be a breastfeeder.
Yeah. I'm a natural chest feeder. She's like, yeah, we should put her on Weight Watchers. And then I thought of Mame, our grandmother, mm-hmm. and was like, Mame would have that baby on Weight Watchers.
Well, apparently my mom likes to tell me, like, I was a baby, like, people would be like, oh, like, she's so pretty, and then they'd pick me up and be like, whoa, she's solid.
That's like Matilda.
Yeah.
She's like carrying a sack of milk. She's like, 13 pounds.
A sack of milk.
She's like carrying a 13
what pound sacks bag. Of milk are you carrying?
That's what it feels like when I pick her up. Especially after I feed her, I can like feel
she's
the
so
like
droopy.
Liquid.
She's just like very puddly.
Yeah. She's so funny.
She really is.
She's getting vocal. Like she's starting to like make her opinions known already. She'll be like, ah! When we're doing something that she doesn't want to do.
Yeah, we're all in trouble when that kid starts talking, I think.
I know. Especially since she's, like, already a kid that likes to be around people talking.
Uh-huh.
I'll put her in a quiet room to sleep. Can't do it. If Maggie and I were on a conference call and she, like, passed out.
Yeah. She'll just sit. We talk in our normal voices. We do not whisper.
No.
Or she's her mother's daughter. She likes to be around activity. It puts her right to sleep.
I was thinking about how I should just, like, put a podcast on in her bedroom. Maybe that'll put her to sleep. Uh-huh. It's a whole brave new world. Her first words are, like, woke. Or, like, anti-woke.
I know.
It's going to be hilarious.
It's going to be a whole thing.
My true punishment for all of my sins would be to have a chubby trans kid.
Tune in next week for another riveting episode that will change your life, help you get out of your own way, and solve all the world's problems. I want to thank our composer, Jared Elias, my co-producer and cousin, Maggie, and all of you out there listening. This has been Walk-In's Welcome with Bridget Fettesy. I'm Bridget Fettesy, and you're welcome. It's the dumbest line.